Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order February 7th, 1 p.m. Want to talk to us a little bit about the bills we got, first one at least?
Would that be 2475?
Yes.
Co-chair. All right. Co-chairs, members. House Bill 2475 authorizes the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to recommend declaration of a public safety services emergency for an Oregon county 1 year in advance of the anticipated emergency. This declaration will require a proposed gap funding package passed on an estimate of revenue necessary to restore or maintain minimally adequate public safety services. It authorizes the governing body of the county facing the emergency or the governor to request an appropriation of funds from legislative assembly sources to provide a gap funding package. And then this requires a mandatory referral to the voters of a gap funding structure. If they're passed, the funding continues. If it is not passed, the funding is withdrawn.
So, there you go.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we have our panel come up, Dwight Ellis, Bill Waddle, and Gil. You can go in any order you want. Just make sure you identify yourselves.
Chair of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm accompanied by Commissioner Dwight Ellis from Josephine County and Commissioner Bill Waller from Curry County. These two gentlemen are ground zero of the subject we're about to talk about, and there's some material that's coming to you. I will provide a quick background on the issue and the purpose of House Bill 2475. And then give these two an opportunity to talk about their hands-on experience with it and answer any questions. I apologize in advance. There's some detail with this. It's only two statutes, but it's quite there's some moving parts. So I will move quickly, but I will try not to lose you at the same time. House Bill 2475 comes to you from the request of the Government Efficiency Task Force, which was created last session. And its purpose was to review state and county shared services in an effort to make them more effective and cost-efficient. The task force was led by, as chair, Nancy Nathanson, and included the offices of the governor, secretary of state, chief justice, state agencies, other legislators, county leaders, and others. There were subcommittees and technical committees. The two statutes that would be amended by this bill were adopted last session. They established the process to declare a public safety services emergency in a fiscally distressed county. In the view of the Government Efficiency Task Force and AOC, however, the law does not provide a complete process that would lead to recovery of the county, and that's the purpose of this bill. Under current law, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission has established by rule guidelines to identify the minimally adequate level at which public safety services must be delivered in a county. The guidelines must provide a basis for analyzing an array of services under the umbrella of public safety. And you see those services listed in the first bullet of my testimony. Guidelines to evaluate a county's current level of public safety based on its historic level of the same set of services. If a county governing body or the governor believes that a county's in a state of fiscal distress, it compromises its ability to provide minimally adequate public safety services, the governing body or the governor may seek a declaration of a public safety emergency by written request to the Criminal Justice Commission to analyze the services provided by that county. The Commission has 14 days to consult, analyze, and prepare findings and recommendations to the Governor. The Governor then has 14 days after the receipt of the findings to make either a declaration of public safety emergency or that there, in fact, is not such an emergency. If the governor says there is an emergency and so declares, he or she will appoint a fiscal control board for the county. The fiscal control board consists of three non-voting ex officio members, the secretary of state, state treasurer, and the director of the Department of Revenue. And five members who have knowledge of and experience with public safety services and fiscal management, three of whom appointed by the governor, one each by the Senate President and House Speaker. All state agencies are directed to assist the Fiscal Control Board. This board will meet with county public safety stakeholders and the public and propose a recovery plan, which could include a number of actions to be taken by the county governing body. And you see those in the sixth bullet, my testimony. The county governing body approves the recovery plan. The Fiscal Control Board will provide technical assistance. The county governing body, however, rejects it. The Fiscal Control Board will stay in effect and monitor the situation and be available to provide assistance if eventually asked. When the Fiscal Control Board concludes that the minimally adequate public safety services have been restored, then it will recommend such to the governor. And then we'll make a determination whether to continue the declaration or to terminate. The Government Efficiency Task Force and AOC support current law, but it is incomplete and the emergency. Voters have not been inclined to vote for higher taxes to replace revenues that, in fact, may not need to be replaced. Prime working example of this for counties is the Federal Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. That act provided revenues in 2009 that supplied at least 20% of general fund revenues or road revenues for 24 of the 36 counties. The original act was set to expire in 2007. Yet common experience was that voters assumed it would be reauthorized, which indeed it was for 1 year. Josephine County sent a local option levy to voters specifically for public safety services in the 2007 primary election. Before ballots were due, however, news of the likelihood of reauthorization was widespread, and the measure was defeated 60-40. Leading up to the second expiration of the federal law, Governor Kulongoski created the Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services, which produced findings and recommendations in January of 2009 for actions when the federal law expires. At the same time, Josephine County put creation of a county special district for safe sheriff services on the 2008 general election ballot. Yet at the figurative last hour, September 2008, Congress reauthorized the federal payments until 2012. That's 2012. That's coming up soon. The Josephine County measure, needless to say, was defeated 60-40. County governing body members and stakeholders know that it's much more expensive and inefficient to rebuild a dismantled public safety service system than to trim it deeply but keep it functioning until revenues are returned to it. Five-year local option levy for the 2010 general election, which was crushed 72-28. If voters stay cynical about the urgency of local funding for public safety system, and the message from Congress that there is not going to be another reauthorization of secure rural schools bears out, there may indeed be counties with non-functioning, dismantling public safety systems. County voters may then wish to tax themselves for public safety, but collections will be at least a year away. Moreover, recommendations of the Fiscal Control Board likely already have been thought of and acted on by the county governing body. Then what? Here's what House Bill 2475 will permit: an anticipatory assessment by the Criminal Justice Commission of when a county will no longer be able to provide a minimally adequate level of public services. Under current law, the CJC reacts to, rather than anticipates, the crisis, permitting the commission to find that a breach of standard will occur within 1 year will reduce the subsequent gap of county financing. The bill will have the Fiscal Control Board include in its recommendations an estimate of revenue needed to return to or maintain the minimal standard of services. In other words, it will estimate a potential gap funding amount. The bill will provide that the details of the gap funding package will be negotiated by the Fiscal Control Board and the county governing body. It will also provide that the county election on public safety measure would be held at the May or November regular election date. Finally, the bill will permit a gap funding package to be offered by the state if the county will hold an election on an adequate local measure, creating a funded law enforcement district or a local option levy for law enforcement. The county measure fails, the gap funding will stop. The measure passes, the gap funding will continue until the county can borrow on anticipated property tax revenues. The Government Efficiency Task Force and AOC respectfully request that you pass.
Whichever one of you wants to continue.
Well, I guess I will continue, sir. My name is Commissioner Dwight Ellis. Again, I'm from Josephine County. Been a county commissioner there for 6 years. I have seen these levies come, and because of threats of the Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act funding, they would not be reauthorized or renewed. And when the voters get their ballot in the mail, that's when the news comes out that it's been reauthorized. And so what it is, it's like we're crying wolf all the time to try to get the taxpayers to pay for our public safety system, and then the money shows up, and they're saying, see, you had this all along. You don't need to increase your taxes, or you don't need this levy, or you don't need these districts. Of course, sentiment nationwide in many areas is that we ought to be cutting and reducing instead of putting levies on the ballot and things like that. And I think that is especially true in the county that I come from. Our median wage income is 79% of the state's, which is one of the lowest in the 36 counties, making us, of course, one of the lowest in the entire United States. We have a lot of poor folks in our county. It's very difficult to get a levy passed, even though our sheriff is probably the most popular sheriff that I've seen in the 20-plus years that I've been in Josephine County. They are not willing to dig any deeper into their pocketbooks and come up with the money that it would take to support adequate law enforcement. And I think the reason is because they've seen the money continue to come and continue to come. When the money stops, I think that's going to change a lot of attitudes there. When the sheriff no longer has the ability to do patrol, when there's only 18 jail beds left because he's had to cut down to 10 or 11 deputies in the jail, when there's no detectives to do investigations or follow-up investigations for any crimes, then they will start to see that we have a major problem in public safety. So I think once that happens, this gap will help us to bridge between the time that the crash happens and the time that we can get something on the ballot, get a levy or a district passed. Thank you.
Bill?
Commissioner Bill Waddle from
Curry County. Part of it, in particular to Curry County, and you have in front of you, I think, some notes that our sheriff provided with me that you have copies of. You can see what we're currently able to provide, and then he has gone through the next three fiscal years, and I can tell you that the three commissioners right now, we're cautiously optimistic with the remaining reserves that we have, as well as one more SRS payment, that we can provide two more somewhat diminished, but again, cautiously optimistic, at least to provide some level of mandated services for two more years. If you'll pardon the pun, but we will fall off the cliff in fiscal year 13-14. That's when we'll have used up our reserves, we'll have used up our last IRS payment, we will have 50% of the revenue needed to maintain levels at some 12-15% below our present ability to provide those services. So I would entertain any questions you may have in getting any of those specifics, but we're here before you to certainly support the legislation that's being asked for.
Okay, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I've been waiting for a moment to say this in this committee, like I said it in every other committee. You know, these payments are being cut off. The people in these counties don't want payments. They want to have access to the land so they can cut timber, mine aggregate, minerals, access to the water, graze their cattle. That's the answer. That's the answer to these problems. And hopefully, it seems like we're going the other way. And it's very frustrating for me. I'm confident it's far more frustrating to the working families out there that you guys are representing. My question is, I don't see on your list of things on page 3, I don't see fire service on here. Where does that fit into all this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, counties do not provide firefighting.
So, may I follow up, Mr. Chair? So, but okay, but you have fire services out in this list of counties. How are they dealing with all this and funding, and how are they suffering from all this, or are they not?
Mr. Chair,
in Josephine County, we are unique in that we have 4 small fire districts that cover the populated areas. The rest of the county is basically uncovered. I expect that on the ballot coming up in November of 2011, there will be a district to cover that unincorporated or that area that is not covered. That was tried the last election. It went down by a 2/3 vote also. People do not want to pay for fire protection. They just don't want to pay for anything.
Thank you.
Just if I may add to that, sir.
Also, in Curry County, we have a number of fire districts, a lot of volunteer. When you get into what happens here in a couple of years when we can no longer provide the dispatch and 911 coverage, then I think you can see how the situation will exacerbate itself. The fact that someone's going to have a fire and there'll be no 911 to direct the fire department to the location.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, it's a real problem, and I endorse, Representative Shoffler's point in this state that God's blessed this state with water and timber, and we're not using it. I just attended a conference in Bend where it's poverty, partnership in poverty, and the fact is a lot of people don't have the money. When you look at people living on the poverty level, when you take away rent, insurance, and food, they're in the hole. I did a ride-along with the state police before Thanksgiving, and the first car we stopped, the people had let their car insurance expire because they don't have the money. So, I empathize with you, and I agree with Representative Shoffler, but there's people, it's not that they don't want to pay, many people can't pay, is my point to the commissioners I'd make. Thank you.
Representative Nolan, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a couple things.
One is, appreciate the information you gave us about fire service and use of special districts to provide emergency fire response. On forest lands, we should also understand the role of the State Forestry Department in providing coverage and protection for the assets on both state forest lands and private forest lands through a cooperative agreement with the landowners. So I don't want people to think that there is no coverage out there, although I'm not by any means arguing that it's as good as it could be or should be. If I might follow up. I really appreciate the effort that you all and whoever else participated in drafting this legislation to look to a sustainable, long-term, and self-sufficient solution. Your counties, some other counties around the state, have indeed suffered through reliance on public policies, largely at the federal level. To some extent, we have some culpability at the state level. That have led them to make decisions that you can't argue with the decision there. So I applaud that effort. What I want to understand, the question is, in providing this gap funding, are we looking to counties that might levy currently available room under Measure 5 and 47 and 50? Or how does this interact with those limitations?
Sure, Representative Nolan. You raise a good point about Measure 5 and Measure 50 limitations. These two gentlemen represent counties with very low permanent rates because they were set by Measure 50 by the voters in 1997. at a time when they their counties were benefiting greatly by the federal forest payments that were coming from the lands. The fact that their rates are so low and the issue of compression likely would not come up. The one of the two things that we suggest that could be done by a county is create a new special services district for public safety. That would be in the $10 side of Measure 5. And there may be counties. This would apply statewide. So there may indeed be counties where there might be conceivably some compression. I believe though it would be very minor. The other is a local option levy, which again Measure 5 would affect. And again, the answer would be the same: that in counties, rural, particularly rural counties, with low permanent rates, there is, I wouldn't say plenty of room, but there is capacity there. That if the voters chose to take advantage of it, they could.
Thanks for the information. Thank you.
Representative Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking in the bill where it lists out the types of recommendations that the Fiscal Control Board may recommend, which is on page 2, lines 22 through 31. And what I don't see is any statement about state policy changes that would help the county be more self-sufficient in line with what Representative Schaffler was talking about. Was any thought given to adding that type of a proposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juan, I don't recall it coming up in the Government Efficiency Task Force, but I doubt that we would have any objections to adding it. It certainly is legitimate.
My follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And then in Section 11 on page 3, which begins at line 19,
but it continues on with several sections, it talks about minimally adequate level of public safety,
okay, and then it lists out A through H different items to be talked about, including the county jail, et cetera. Is that intended to be the sole universe of what public safety services means in this context, or is that a limited example, but public safety is intended to be much broader? And how do you define that in this section of the statute?
The way this is written, classic statutory construction, this would be the limited list. If you wished, however, to broaden it, you could say, or other related items, however you want to phrase it. But again, we wouldn't object to that either.
Well, the reason why I ask the question is I want to make sure that we have a good handle on what is intended by public safety so that it doesn't expand into areas that might be more debatable in terms of public safety. I like the list that you have there. And then as a last point, I'd like to echo Representative Schaffler's point. I mean, there are consequences to some of the values and policy choices that are driven by areas outside of rural Oregon. And those consequences are borne disproportionately in rural Oregon. And I'm with Representative Schaffler on this. I think we need to take a stronger look at how our policy choices in the metro area in particular and in Washington, D.C. as well are hurting our neighbors in rural Oregon.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ditto everything Representative Schaffler has said and my other colleagues regarding the optimal use of natural resources. There's definitely a long way to go at both the state government level and even higher at the federal level. That said, I wanted to just ask you to hit a couple of points. Any of the three gentlemen up there, Commissioner Waddle, on your submission here, you do say right up front that within apparently the bulk of Curry County, there is no 24-hour patrol.
That's correct, sir. The only area in Curry County that's under 24-hour patrol is the city of Brookings.
And may I ask, follow up on that? Thank you. So my understanding is that if somebody calls the police 4 hours a day, chances are what's going to happen?
Well, chances are they're not going to get a response, sir. And in fact, as you can see, when you only have 1 to 2 deputies on a county that that basically encompasses almost a third of the Oregon coast. If you have an emergency in the south end of the county, that deputy is probably an hour and 15 or 20 minutes away from getting to the other end of the county.
Thanks.
And there is no backup.
And if I may ask one more, Mr. Chair, I would ask the same question of Commissioner Ellis to describe the patrol presence, both currently and even the historical patrol presence within Josephine County.
Historically, up until about a year ago, we had 12-hour coverage for patrol. 12 hours was not covered in the county. We decided to look at our budget, and we pumped about $700,000 into the sheriff's budget. He has since gone up to 20-hour patrol within the county. The other 4 hours, if anything happens, they wake him up, he goes out, period. That's it, he covers it. And, you know, if we don't get secure rural schools reauthorized, then what's going to happen is the sheriff is going to cover a lot more stuff than he's doing now, and I don't know how he gets any sleep now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Just briefly, so we have the stopgap. Money shuts off. We put in the stopgap. The voters say no. Where are we? I mean, what would you anticipate there?
Well, Mr. Chair, the idea is to extend current law another step further so the voters are aware that this isn't gamesmanship. This is the real thing. But instead of having the whole system crumble until the voters say okay, this would keep things at a minimal level. So beyond that, this bill does not address what happens.
Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, something we're going to do, and when we're actively doing it now in Curry County, is to really make this abundantly clear to the voters that we're in the process of coming up with the monies we have left to provide two level years of service with, optimistically, is going to be at a minimum level of the mandated services, and then all bets are off once we've used up those reserves in that last year of SRS payments, so that they know they will. And we're going to, I mean, we'll do the every possible way of publicly informing them with PowerPoint presentations and so forth, so that everybody will be very clear what's going to happen that third fiscal year from now, 13-14, we're. Again, I would say cautiously optimistic, maybe, that the voters will really truly understand that it's in their best interest to do the right thing.
And we see this on a statewide level as well. The sky's falling and it didn't fall because something kicked in, and so then there's just that more of a lack of trust, and people are very skeptical about those things. And I live in a suburb of Portland, my area and my district, and we have not only the regular sheriff's taxes, we also have an enhanced program up there that I happily vote for, and I don't mind paying taxes for the increased service, but I understand my area is a little, or not a little bit, but very different from yours, and so thank you.
Just a couple of maybe comments. Curry County has the seventh highest senior population of any county in the United States. It's nearly 70% in Brookings alone. At the county level, exactly, I don't know where it is. I also have the highest percentage of veterans. None of those people have got any federal increase on their Social Security or anything else the last 2 years, but the property tax, mine was up. My insurance was up $600 and some on my property. You just saw what the fuel tax and vehicles done. So these people are not inclined to vote for taxes. Not because they don't want the services, but they really are getting pinched. I was contacted by Joe Asme, lobbyist. Ralph Groner. And he was talking about the levies that had been passed up north that were basically forcing seniors out of some of those cities up near Portland because they couldn't afford to live there anymore. Now, when I got to Curry County in 1964, there were 11 mills. There's one today. 75 guys had their own truck. There's two today. The economy just is terrible. The schools were full. There was money in the community then. There's not now. And I'm going to say something that might be real popular, but you know what the root of it is? Extreme environmental wackoism, that we have no access to our natural resources. And you look at the states that are not in trouble. Guess which states are using their natural resources? They are doing the best. We can, in fact, use our timber, use our commercial fish, water, name what it is, in a very environmentally sensitive, stable way for the values that we have for our families and our children. But we, until we start doing that, I don't understand where we think we're going to go. You know, how did either one of you know how long it has been that the federal government provided those funds and they understood that there was an agreement that those lands were going to provide a value for the rural counties? Do you know how long that was honored by the federal government?
I'm sorry.
In other words, you've got the money that was coming to the counties from the federal government off those federal lands, which now isn't coming.
Right.
So because of the lack of multiple use, how long had that been honored?
Well, Mr. Chair, the 25% fund affects National Forest. I believe that that was in put in statute books about 1914, something like that.
So nearly 100 years, give or take.
ONC Act 1937, so it's been a long time.
And, you know, to have an agreement of that type, that long standing, it seems strange that the federal government can just walk away. If they want to walk away, give the counties in the state of Oregon those lands, and we'll manage them much, much better than they're being managed now. The 500,000 acres of biscuit fire right behind my back door, an area I worked at the state police, has got like 3 or 4 billion feet of timber rotting on the ground, not even doing anything environmental. In fact, it's a negative environmental thing. If that land was my land, like my forest land, I'd be in violation of the Oregon Forest Practice Rules. We need to be much more aggressive about going after the federal government when they don't keep their obligations, when they don't take care of the environment. But right now we got a crisis, and I'm not certain where we're going to go with it. Anyone else have anything further?
Chair Krieger, if I could just add on to what you said for a second.
Especially when you talk about the biscuit
fire, 500,000 acres. It's scientifically proven that every 20,000 acres that a forest that burns and is allowed to decay like the biscuit fire, that's the same as 1 million automobiles, 365 days, the CO2 exchange. So when we start talking about the environment, there's nothing worse than we could do than to allow those fires to burn and then not even try to go in there and salvage what was left over. We had a young forester talk to us last week on that same subject. He's been back into that biscuit area, and he can tell you without and with all candor that fuel load is building up, and the second time that goes, it's going to be worse than the first. The second thing I'd like to say, sir, if I may, when you talk about the economics and not being able for a county like Curry County to use its natural resources, 42% of the parents in Curry County have a history of drug and alcohol abuse. That's 42%. Why is that? That's because they have not had a good economic foundation. They haven't been able to take and work and provide for their families. And we see the result of what happens to that. So we've got a number of kids. I'm going to guess somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% of all kids are on some kind of a food policy now. And I can tell you that a number of us volunteer every single week down at the food bank to provide lunches for those kids, and they can sack them up and go home because it's probably the only lunch they're going to get until they come back to school on Friday, or from Friday to Monday. So when I say we have a bad situation, I mean it.
Anything further from the committee? Okay, thank you.
I did want to follow up because I think it's important for us to understand what the baseline that we're trying to establish is. And I thought I heard the two county representatives speak about your ability to provide round-the-clock public safety coverage. And I thought I heard you say that even during the time when the federal payments were available and being received, you were not able to provide 24-hour coverage.
That's correct. In the case of Curry County, yes, ma'am.
So at some point, understanding budget challenges, and we will be facing some very serious ones here ourselves this year, even with that flow of federal support, you weren't able within your county budgets to be able to provide that kind of service. So are we expecting that this gap funding or the new levies will lift your capacity back up to where it was or to a higher level than you were able to provide before?
Mr. Chair? Yes, go ahead.
When and if we go out for a levy or a sheriff's district or whatever we go out for,
it will not be at a higher level than we currently are at.
It would basically have zero chance of passing. The sheriff tells me that what he's currently got with 20-hour coverage patrol with half the jail full, it's got 262 beds, and he's got about 130 beds that are occupied right now. He says that is minimal adequate. He doesn't want to go below those numbers. But when we go out for a levy, we are not going to try to increase any of those numbers. We're going to try to maintain status quo in our county.
And just a quick follow-up. It seems to me that given the other challenges that your county residents are facing, they think I'm struggling with how to say this. They think that that's the best choice to make, rather than they've already rejected some other public safety levies that would have allowed you to raise that level. So they're trying to strike a balance here, wanting some minimal level of public safety, but also being conscious of what their own individual and business capacity to support that financially is.
Mr. Chair, in order to maintain our current public safety system, which includes juvenile, mm-hmm. the district attorney,
the sheriff,
and the jail, we're going to have to put at least $2 per thousand on a levy. Currently, they're paying 58 cents per thousand. They would be paying $2.58 per thousand to support those services. Mm-hmm. It's going to be extremely difficult to get the voters of Josephine County to pay an extra $2 per thousand.
Like I said, the sheriff's very popular,
but they don't have it. They say they don't have it, and I believe them. It's going to be a difficult situation.
I don't doubt you. Thank you.
For Representative Nolan, back in my prior life working there, that county, I went there in 64. We had, right after that, we had a deputy at Agnes, we had a deputy at Langlois, we had two in Port Orford, three or four in Gold Beach, and three and four in Brookings. And we're down to, what, four or five, Bill?
We have, Chair Krieger and Representative Nolan, we have five patrol deputies right now. When our sheriff was a deputy back in the late 90s, we had 16.
So there's been a great reduction.
Mr. Chair, this may surprise you, but I would be inclined to agree with your analysis, although perhaps not be as colorful as you were in it. That the real challenge is the commercial and industrial base to support local services.
Yeah, you're right. Representative Schaffer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the efforts of the work group and you gentlemen and everybody that contributed and what you're trying to do here. But there is just no way that tax increase is going to pass. Let's just be realistic. I do not see it happening. I'm grateful to hear my colleague over here say that clearly the solution is getting people to work. That is the only way out. I will submit to you that if none of that happens, people will just drag up and leave. And I will also suggest
that's what a lot of people want to see happen. They don't live there. They live in a concrete jungle somewhere, but that's exactly what they want to see happen. And that's, it's like telling a bunch of farmers in Iowa to quit growing corn. Drag up, let it grow to weeds, and go back to wherever it is, or go wherever you got to go. And it's disgusting. It's criminal. And I hope that doesn't happen. But God bless you for coming here.
Okay, thank you.
Just some more information for Representative Nolan. We spent 10 months in 2009 with a Blue Ribbon Committee on law enforcement and trying to come up with a district, law enforcement district. When we finally got the number and how costly that would be in the neighborhood of $3.91, then is when we backed off and said, well, maybe we'll try this five-year levy. And so we tried that at $2.21, and as you can see from your information there, it was defeated 72 to 28. It's just the sentiment is not there. The economics for most of those voters aren't there to support that. Our tax rate is a penny more than Josephine County's at 59 cents.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary, did you want to come up and say something briefly on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We actually represent people who work in Josephine County, though heaven knows there's not many of them. And there's fewer every day. We are actually supporting this bill, not as a solution, but as at least a one step in the process towards gaining a solution. And at the risk of inciting to riot my Green Caucus in my union, I will continue to support cutting a tree every now and then or taking one off of burned out land. As long as it also includes milling and processing and employing Oregonians. I am the child of loggers and timber workers and dairy farmers. And though I was raised in Portland and consider myself an environmentalist, I don't think I'm a wacko. because I actually think there's room for both. And I sat through every mind-numbing meeting that the Timber Task Force had, and trust me, most of them were at times mind-numbing. But I now know more than I ever think I wanted to know about the timber industry and the issues and all of the issues surrounding the SRS funding. And I may be in the minority, but I do not believe that the SRS funding should be ramped down. As long as the federal government owns our land and continues policies that lock the land down, then I think that they need to sort of take the attitude that I've taken, which is we're all Oregonians here and we all love trees. Some of us love them standing up and some of us love them laying down. But we all love them. And we really ought to think about how we utilize our natural resources to provide family wage jobs for working Oregonians in rural counties on a long-term basis and rebuild the rural economy by creating some jobs that are long-term and pay a decent wage and a family benefit, as well as figuring out what we use as in the way of recreational and set-asides. And I think there's room for both. If everybody just sort of takes a breath and takes a step back and stops being reactionary to the point of insanity, then I think we can get there. And I just caution everybody to do the right thing. And right now, I don't know how Josephine County survives. You know, we've all seen the numbers. Curry's the first one to go. Josephine or Douglas are the second, and the third. I mean, it is not acceptable for us to say these are counties we don't need anymore. It's just not acceptable. We need to find some solutions, and we need to be partners with the counties. And our union can fight with our counties on our own time, but when we're here in this building, we're all here together, and we need to find some solutions. And I think this at least gives them some breathing room. I don't think it solves the problem, but I think it gives them some breathing room. And more importantly, it gives an orderly process to the problem. And we would encourage you to pass the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Any further questions for you guys?
Thank you.
I would just say if it was a state problem only and the feds weren't involved and we didn't have the Endangered Species Act and some other things, which I'm not saying we shouldn't have an Endangered Species Act, but the way that it's been developed and a punitive, we probably at the state level could sit down as legislators and make it work and have those counties prosper. But the minute the federal government gets involved in natural resources, look out. As such, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2475, and the gavel is going to go over to the co-chair.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2650. Eric, would you give us a brief explanation?
Thank you, co-chairs, members. House Bill 2650, presently, long-term caregivers, mental health professionals, and some other classes designated by the statute under ORS 443004 sub 1 are subject to criminal checks as a condition of employment. House Bill 2650 will centralize that, requiring Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services to develop systems that run those checks, and they'll be run quarterly.
Call up Megan Moyer, Lauren Rhodes, and Mary Botkin, please. You're not on that one?
Come on,
you signed up on the wrong sheet. Okay, that's okay. Andrea, you can come up there, please. And go ahead in any order and just... identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. We represent over 15,000 direct care providers in long-term care, and we are supportive of House Bill 2650 because we are looking for a way to create greater efficiency and portability in criminal background checks for workers in a field that has a lot of transferring of positions, transferring of facilities, and even workers working in multiple programs. So the goal of 2650 is to see if there's a way for the state to streamline its criminal background check process and allow workers portability within their field. If this is possible, we'll be saving workers, employers, and the state significant resources over time.
The concept behind 2650 is
to have a worker go through the criminal background check as it is currently written, so they would need to meet whatever standard is currently laid out. And if
they do so and are approved as an appropriate care provider in that setting, they could voluntarily choose
to be on a registry. That registry would be checked quarterly with state police records to identify any future arrests or convictions. But if none are found, that worker's criminal background check would be portable and valid for new employment within their field. This bill, through conversations with many different stakeholders, it's clear that there will probably need to be a few amendments to make this bill implementable. And that's why we look forward to convening a work group to see if we can't find a way to make this happen and hopefully save the state some resources while affording that portability for workers. There's also another added benefit of this concept, and that is greater protection for vulnerable Oregonians in long-term care. Today, a worker, depending on the setting that they work in, could possibly work for an indefinite period of time without ever being rechecked. if they do not change positions, if they do not change employers, they are not required to have another criminal background check. The employer would have no way of knowing if that individual may have run into the law and may have an arrest or conviction that would call to question their fitness of being a care provider. With a system of rechecking every quarter for new arrests or convictions, the state would be able to identify if there was a situation where someone was no longer an appropriate person to be providing care. So I think the concept behind 2650 really allows, hopefully, for greater efficiency, portability, and safety. Thank you.
The committee. For the record, Lauren Rose, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We employ almost 45,000 employees across the state in long-term care facilities, including skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, licensed in-home care agencies, and senior housing. And we are very supportive of the concepts behind House Bill 2650 because we are required to conduct criminal background checks on every applicant for employment in long-term care. So we are running many, many thousands of criminal background checks every time someone applies for a job, and this would really increase both the efficiency in terms of the department and the number of checks that they're running, and also reduce costs on employers who are required to pay for all of the checks conducted throughout the long-term care system. I understand from conversations with Megan that there are some potential changes to this, and we're happy to work with SEIU and other interested parties on finding a good solution that actually meets the needs of both the employees and employers in long-term care. Happy to take any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Ms. Meyer.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. I think I'm that other party. The ACLU, just to go into a little bit of history, because the issue you're working on in this bill has actually got a long history in Oregon and in this legislature, beginning briefly with teachers and the use of fingerprint for criminal history background checks. To do an FBI criminal history background check requires the statutory authority, and it goes to the Oregon State Police. While there was changes over the years, it wasn't until 2005 when Representative Cameron, who must have been out of the room when he got the assignment, shepherded House Bill 2157, which was a de-engrossed version that was finally passed, and it's 65 pages long. And it was a work group of everyone coming to the table in agencies and departments who want the authority to do criminal history background checks with the FBI through the Oregon State Police for licenses, employment, and otherwise. So we worked on that, and there are a few important criteria for us that have always been present, and the legislature has made the policy decision. One, which isn't really affected by this legislation, but I'll talk about it's mentioned, is sort of the fitness determination. When someone has a criminal history, that does not mean that employment isn't appropriate or license isn't appropriate. Rather than set forth in most legislation that if you've had this conviction, you can't have that job or that license, we leave it to the departments or agencies to do what's called a fitness determination. How long ago? Have they had employment? Are there recommendations? Have they really changed who they are in terms of the context of what their previous conviction was? That's an important criteria. The other policy decision made at the get-go was that we would not allow, and it's in the statute, the FBI to retain the fingerprints taken. Now, we're all digital, but at the time these laws were originally enacted, it was the fingerprint cards, and they were sent off to the FBI, and the statute required that the FBI either destroy or return to the state agency, and in turn that the state agency destroy the fingerprints. We do not want to create a database of fingerprints of people who've never been convicted of a crime. House Bill 2650, what it partly does is remove that provision. It removes the provision, I think, with the idea that because there may be the need to do these, as you've heard already, multiple fingerprint criminal history checks over the years, that I guess one of the pieces is to keep the fingerprints by the state. That is something that we would strongly oppose. But I have been saying for the last few years that there needs to be a global fix to this, and the reason I think we're really venturing into a large work group is because whatever fix we do for any agency or entity every other agency or entity will come in probably with about 20 different proposals next session. I think in 2005 there were five or six, but then everyone came in and added to the bill to allow some provision to allow this issue, which is moving around in employment and otherwise the need for these background checks. And this, in a way, only solves part of the problem. I mean, it retains the fingerprints, but it doesn't, there's still a cost of sending them to the FBI for the criminal history background check. So we're actually not necessarily even getting to the fix, because the retention of fingerprints has to cost money. And we would just urge that whether we can do this during the session, the ACLU is certainly committed to bringing, you know, whether it's DAS and others and Oregon State Police, all of us, some of us have been around long enough, we've worked on this for a long time, to see if we can globally fix it. We're concerned also about the idea of a registry. Last night it was clean box, the idea that if you've had the check done and you've had no criminal history, you're clean, and you can voluntarily choose to be in that clean box. The problem is, to us, it's like a scarlet letter, but not. There are a lot of people who have criminal history. Let's just pick a marijuana charge from 20 years ago that probably under any employment issue or licensing would not prohibit them from that job. But if we have a clean box where you've had to have no criminal history, you could never be on that. And we don't want to create the situations where employers and others are saying, hey, join the clean box. And the employee has to explain, I can't, and here's why, for various reasons. So we need to find solutions, and again, to reiterate, we're committed to this, but there's a lot of stakeholders that need to be brought to table and some creative thinking. I've talked to Oregon State Police, Patricia Whitfield, about this for a few years, and we don't have the perfect bullet yet. So for those reasons, at this point, we would oppose House Bill 2650, but as I said, remain committed to working on this global fix.
Any questions?
Hey, I can't imagine sending the same thing in every 3 months. I can, as long as you keep your job, keep the fingerprints, and you lose your job, then just send them back or get rid of them rather than send it in every 3 months. But that's not really my question. We want to check this every quarter, every 3 months you want to do someone's background check, and how many people would we be checking every 3 months, and how much would all that cost? And then how many people do we catch doing something bad that we got to fire as a result of all that checking? Do you have that information? And if you don't, just get it to me whenever you feel like it.
Representative Schaffler, I don't have the exact numbers. The check is not a full check. Today, if I'm going through the process, I'm applying to be some kind of long-term care worker, they're going to do a fitness determination. That's not what the quarterly check would be. The quarterly check would be a data match. It'd be a batch file that would be matched to the state police. Obviously, I think there are details that would need to be worked out to make sure that this was, in fact, a cost savings and not adding additional costs. But the goal would be not to be doing the man hours of doing a true determination, but rather simply looking for a data match.
Mr. Chair, and then how many people do you see being impacted by this? You find something in their background or through this every now and then, you just check out that they have to lose their job. I mean, you must have some reason for doing this all the time. As a result of that, how many people currently lose their job as a recurring background check? If you get it later, it's okay. It's a big question.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffer, to your point, right now we don't know because, for instance, when someone applies for a job at an assisted living facility, we run a background check, but then we never check them again throughout their time. And so what this would do would simply allow the employer to have that information so that they're making an appropriate decision about that person's employment.
Thank you.
And then if I'm the person, I have my check, I'm working at your care agency, and I, for whatever reason, decide to move to the new boss, Schaffler, then I don't have to go through the whole check again. Is that right? That this quarterly, they just do a quick sweep to see, has there been an arrest?
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wisnant? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add, so some of the solutions to think about are, you can do a name check without the fingerprints. And if someone has full employment and can show they haven't missed any work, they've been fully employed, they're still residing in Oregon, I think, one, a state name check is, I think, just the state, so you're not checking out of state. But I think if you can show that they've had full employment and not left the state, and it's highly unlikely that they've been arrested for a serious crime and been away from the job and been convicted in another state and have done their time. Likewise, you know, while it's true they aren't doing these ongoing checks, if someone is arrested for a serious crime, they're probably not showing up to their job, and there's some, so there is some uncovery of some of the more serious crimes. They actually might not be able to go back to their job. They might be incarcerated. So it's not without some checks right now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been part of the Judiciary Committee for several sessions, and we keep adding more and more people to get background checks and criminal checks. Mr. Chair, first I'd like to ask Mr. Knott, is there a difference between a criminal background check and a background check? Is there, or is that the same, or there?
And co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, as far as I know, a background check can take a variety of different forms. It can be done, you know, they can be calling your employer, they can be calling your family, they can be calling places where you live. A criminal check is a formal proceeding that's going to run exclusively through Oregon State Police and access law enforcement databases. So it targets differently.
So all of our rules or laws that we passed have been criminal background checks we're requiring.
As to this statute, this is a criminal background check.
Okay, Mr. Chair. 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, we had an employee working in Bend, Oregon for the OLCC. And come to find out he'd stolen identity, was using a false name. He's now serving, just been convicted of crime, doing prison time, and he'll be deported because he was a foreign from Bulgaria. The point that he'd had a check, but it wasn't the right check. So then what happened last year in the General Government Committee, we had DAS and we had DHS come in. And members, I would estimate that the government of Oregon is probably spending over $200 million a year on background checks. So this will count as my one time a year degree of ACLU. And I fully agree that this is a very, very detailed problem that Representative Hovey and I have talked about having a work group. We need to decide how many we need, what kind we need. Do they need to go to FBI? Do they need to be state police? We're spending a lot of the taxpayers' money to do this. And I understand and support fully protecting the public and being sure that we're not allowing the wrong kind of people to be doing our working with children or our needy and things like that. But it really does take, it's going to take a lot of study and work to figure out. In the military, you know, we have a problem, we overreact. And I think that's what we've done with background checks, is we've overreacted. We need to find out what's the right level and not spend all the taxpayers' money on this. Thank you.
I'd point out, recently I signed up to be a volunteer. I had to do a background check. I just did it online, no fingerprints, and they docked me $3. So I don't think that particular one cost the state much. They just do a quick search by name and date of birth.
Look at your date of birth and figure you weren't dangerous.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. My senior friend over there.
Over the knees.
There we go. There.
Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you very much. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I guess this isn't really a question, but we had a hearing this morning in Human Services Committee about something similar. But the point was made that we're talking about the most vulnerable people, some people who are not able to speak or communicate in any way. So it's especially important for us, the state, to make sure that the people who are caring for them have no criminal activities. I have no problem with people, the caregivers of these very, very vulnerable people, having frequent searches of possible criminal or unlawful activity. I think it's our responsibility to make sure that they're safe and cared for. So that's just my take.
Thank you. Close the public hearing at House Bill 2650. Okay. Committee will stand at ease for a few minutes.
Thank you. Yeah,
it didn't work with the OLCC. We had the wrong
time. Yeah, I read about that in the paper.
is House Bill 2696. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2696. Mr. Dodd, if you could give us a brief summary, please.
Thank you, Co-Chairs. Member, House Bill 2696 changes the existing ORS 165107. This is the statute that regulates the records that scrap metal businesses are required to record. Right now, there are essentially two categories under that bill. There are commercial sellers, and then there are individuals. This will create a third for nonprofit corporations, and it also changes the procedure of what happens. Right now, you are required to receive payment for scrap metal if you are an individual in the form of a check. It'll add provisions to describe what happens to that check if nobody comes to pick it up.
No, I'm going to speak from right here, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair. I do.
This is one of you. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. This is a continuation of Senate Bill 570, if you remember from the 2009 session. And we did a little bit of tweaking and fixing in February last year with 570, and now this is a continuation. There were three different times that Bill Taylor and I and Josh Nasby down at LC met with a number of folks that represented the law enforcement community as well as the recycling industry and some other folks that were interested in this. There were two things that we focused on, and Aaron has kind of mentioned a little bit of that. But the first one dealt around the idea of what happens with the commercial non-seller, the non-profit corporation. And I'll just give you an example of how we designed this. If a non-profit corporation was interested in receiving funds and donations from someone that was working on their own to go through a neighborhood collecting metal, and then the dollars from those, the proceeds, the dollars from that scrap metal then would eventually go to the nonprofit, there was no connection to be able for the recycler to be able to write a check and go directly to. They had to actually write it back to the individual who was bringing it in. It really complicated things. So we worked on that, and everybody that was at the table felt, well, let's just add this piece to that and just sidestep that and go right straight to the nonprofit organization. For example, Albany has Helping Hands. You could do that for them. It's nonprofit, and if you had folks going out collecting metal and then dropping it off and selling it to Bertram's Metals down there, they could then in turn send the check directly to Helping Hands, for example. And that's what that was all about. The second piece was a continued issue that the recyclers were having problems with when someone would bring metal in, they would send a check out, and then it would be returned to them, maybe wrong address. By law, they're required to hang on to that for 30 days. And unless the individual comes in and shows that they have a current address, then they could retrieve. Actually, they would be receiving it again through the mail. Well, what this does is it kind of makes a situation where if an individual does not have a current address, but if they go to the local law enforcement agency and gets that recommendation and authorization from the law enforcement agency that they can receive the check, then that just approves that. But, and it just streamlines everything along that line.
So what about local law enforcement? How do they feel about becoming involved in that?
They were fine with that.
Any questions? Representative Nolan, please.
Does the bill, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, I'm sorry if I haven't peruse the bill in detail, but does the bill authorize local law enforcement to charge a fee for its services? We just heard about local law enforcement struggling to provide basic services. I'm not sure that this body wants to impose additional responsibilities on them without a capacity to cover the cost of providing that service.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, there's nothing in the bill that addresses that issue. But again, of the folks that were there representing the law enforcement community, they were fine with it.
Point of clarification. Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, the closest provision that goes to what you're speaking of, the form that this is going to take is just a letter. It's any written authorization. So that's all law enforcement is required to produce.
But,
I'm sorry.
Will they be custodian of this?
That is not addressed in the bill.
Appreciate what you're saying, and yep. Representative Olson, I have no doubt that you would be concerned about making sure local law enforcement representatives are interested in this. But we see all too often circumstances where programs evolve and become more expansive, shall we say, than the original program without additional legislation at all.
Okay.
And I just want to make sure we're not inadvertently creating a burden that you don't intend, that the sponsors of the bill don't intend.
I guess Mr. Chair, my question would be then, from what Representative Nolan's just brought up, is are you thinking that the law enforcement agency would then be the one who would be the owners of the check at that time, or would it stay with the recycling agency?
Parsed the bill carefully, Mr. Chair, I'd be inclined to leave the law as it is. If you don't have a current address, you don't have a means of getting paid, and if the payment needs to go somewhere else, I think it gets treated like other forfeited property and it goes to the common school fund.
Well, that's not how the law is designed. It actually stays with the recycler if it's not, you know, stepped up to and retrieved.
In 30 days. So in 30 days, if nobody picks up, the recycler keeps the money.
That's correct.
Well, I'd be happy to help you fix it so that it gets treated like other abandoned property. I think it is abandoned property, right? If I'm entitled to a refund check from any other service in the state, if I don't get that check or cash it, it becomes abandoned property and it goes to the common school fund. Maybe you and I can work together on that.
Representative Olson, do you have any idea about how many unclaimed checks there are?
I have no idea.
I don't either. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems that we've worked on this issue for a long time, and I'm still unclear why this is necessary. It seems to me that was one of the first issues that we had decided on either 2 or 4 years ago when we were first discussing this issue, how important it was to have checks mailed to a real address rather than somebody picking something up. And I'm having trouble understanding why we're taking a step back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, actually, Rob Ovette from the Lincoln County DA's office, who was the original crafter of Senate Bill 570, we added a few things. He's here. He might be able to bring a little bit of clarification for you.
Thank you.
Come on up, Rob.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for the record, Rob Ovette, District Attorney from Lincoln County. I'm not here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. They're officially neutral on the bill, but as Representative Olson mentioned, I was together with other folks, some of the primary crafters of Senate Bill 570, and I agree with you, Representative. Actually, we took the Washington model, strengthened it, and I will report to you generally the feedback we're getting is the legislation is very successful, and we like what's happening. But we recognize, and I believe Representative Olson kind of mentioned it, we recognize very early on that this was a very large piece of legislation that was changing things pretty dramatically, and we made kind of a commitment to everyone that we would come back and do a series of technical fixes, and I suspect this is not the last of them. The nonprofit issue makes sense to me just as a practical matter, and I understand your hesitation and your kind of reluctance with this additional piece about having a law enforcement agency basically say, give their stamp of approval after the check comes back and say, okay, now you can give it to them personally. And I also hear your concern, Representative Nolan, about the cost of that. But the way it's actually crafted, House Bill 2696 doesn't require law enforcement to do anything. So if they just want to say, no, we're not going to issue these letters as a general blanket matter, there's nothing in this legislation that requires them to do it at all. The other thing is there nothing that prohibits them from charging a fee for that service? Say they wanted to do a full criminal records background on someone like that. I think the basic idea is here to note that the people that are really going to abuse metals theft and are going to go rip off the utility and go into the metals recycler because they're addicted to meth or whatever it happens to be aren't going to be the people that are going to go into law enforcement and say, hey, would you clear me to get this check and go through that process. So if you want to tighten it up even further, I'm comfortable with this. And I will tell you that if we ran into problems, I'd be the first one to be back before this committee saying, no, we went a little too loose. We need to tighten it back up again. I'm relatively comfortable with what we have here. I don't think this is going to be used hardly at all. And I think each law enforcement agency can decide whether they want to allow the resources to be used in this fashion and or whether they want to charge a fee for it. If you want to make those two things explicit, you certainly can, but that's the way I read it.
Thank you for that information. If the meth addict isn't likely to go to law enforcement because they don't have an address, who are you trying to help with that part of this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I didn't actually craft this bill, but I was part of some of the early conversations. We're trying to help the folks that don't have a hard physical address to mail it to, such as folks with a post office box and it gets returned, folks that with law enforcement could, if they ran a criminal backgrounds check or if whatever resources they looked at, so could put a full stamp of approval on releasing it to this person, but the bill is too tight to allow that.
Just a quick follow-up. If you could educate those of us who don't spend all of our days in that world, a couple of examples?
Sure. Myself, for example, I don't have a physical address that you can mail things to me. I just don't. I have a post office box. I won't bore you with all the details of it, but that's the way I work. I haven't recycled metals lately. Frankly, I've never recycled metals. But if I had a pile of whatever it is in my backyard that I needed to recycle and went to my recycler, I couldn't give him a physical address to mail it to me. I could actually maybe give him my work address, but that, some might argue, would be abuse of my position in using physical address at the courthouse, and that's not what it says anyway. So I'm an example. So I could go to my police chief and I say, Chief, or can you assign someone and have them clear me to get this check over the counter and essentially escape this kind of tightening. I think it's an appropriate tightening, but that's just one example. I don't know if that makes sense.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nola, good question. You want another example? And probably one of the largest ones that we heard down there, I mean, from my area anyways, were people who were homeless. There are a number of people that I know that are homeless that are very solid people. It's just that is where they're at right now, and this is one of the means that they're finding to go around and collect metal, and people give that to them free, and they follow the process to get it to the recycler and everything. But the problem is they do not have a permanent address. Law enforcement knows who they are.
Thank you. I guess I'm
still looking at the staff measure summary, and it says requires nonprofit corporations to receive a check payment by check. It doesn't say anything about individuals, but like Representative Nolan, I haven't read this thoroughly. But you're saying it would be individuals, not only nonprofit corporations. Is that correct?
Two different, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we're talking two different things here.
Okay.
The nonprofit,
got
for
it.
An individual,
right.
Collecting and then routing that check there through the recycler, and then the other one would be actually an individual who would deliver it and not be able to receive the check due to a permanent address. So those are the two issues.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, what you're looking for is located on line 13 of page 3. It's a small subsection separate from the section about nonprofits.
Do you have it? Page 3. Line 13.
Further discussion.
Okay, great.
Okay. Hearing none, close the public meeting on House Bill 2696. Any further business to come before the committee? Committee adjourned.